You figure out how to make an MP3?
It's right here on my desk.
Okay.
Well, actually, I just needed to turn it on. I mean, I need to figure out how to turn the darn machine on. But let's see, the little graph that shows our, you know, speaking patterns is going right now, so I think that's good news.
That's a good
sign. We're recording. So the sort of basis for this is to give our readers, which sort of, you know, runs the gamut from big to small, all sorts of, you know, different industries and stuff, a sort of a primer, maybe, because I think this is a topic that probably hasn't been discussed much in PR news before. So I kind of wanted to go through kind of what the process of risk communication is, and maybe talk a little bit about the outrage part of that, because that's certainly hugely interesting. So could you give sort of the, you know, 20,000 foot kind of definition of risk communication and what that sort of entails for people?
All right, let me give you two different 20,000 foot definitions.
Got it.
And see if this takes us anywhere. Mm-hmm. Let me start by describing risk communication the way I define it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's grounded in the extremely low correlation between how serious a risk is technically and how serious people are likely to think it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in study after study, if you correlate, you know, how likely something is to kill people or injure mm-hmm. people or damage ecosystems on the one hand, and how likely it is to get communities upset on the other hand, that correlation comes out around 0.2. Accounting for a glorious 4% of the variance. So if you know a risk is dangerous, it tells you practically nothing about whether it's upsetting. Mm-hmm. If you know it's upsetting, it tells you practically nothing about whether it's dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And I use the terms hazard and outrage to refer to those two aspects of the risk. Hazard mm-hmm. is how dangerous it is technically, and outrage is how likely it is to upset people.
Mm-hmm.
So if you just look at that hazard-outrage relationship and imagine a 2x2 matrix, mm-hmm. you know, hazard is either high or low, outrage is either high or low,
mm-hmm.
You get the main kinds of risk communication. If hazard is high and outrage is low, that is, people are endangered but not upset,
mm-hmm.
You have what I call precaution advocacy.
I see.
You know, shaking people by their collective lapel,
sure.
saying, you know, look, this is dangerous, let's do something. You know, mm-hmm. you wear a seatbelt, you know, wear a hard hat, wear a condom.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily all at the same time.
Sure.
and that's one kind of risk communication.
Okay.
On the opposite extreme, you have, and the one that I suspect you're going to be more interested in, you have a situation where people are upset but not endangered, where the hazard is low,
mm-hmm.
but the outrage is high. Mm-hmm. That assumes, of course, that you actually know whether the hazard is high or low, but
right.
Let's make that assumption.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got people who are upset about something that's in fact not terribly dangerous,
mm-hmm.
and that I call outrage management, and it's a completely different skill set.
Okay.
You know, talking to apathetic people is extremely different from talking to upset people, and you know, the toolkits have nothing in common.
Okay. Okay.
The third corner is when hazard and outrage are both high. People are upset, and they're right to be upset because they're endangered. And you know, you're not trying to calm them down as you are in outrage management. You're not trying to rile them up as you are in precaution advocacy. You're trying to help them bear it, and you're trying to guide them through it. That's crisis communication.
Okay.
Now, I kind of have to interrupt myself to say PR people use the term crisis communication to talk about what I'm calling outrage management.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a crisis for the client.
Sure.
You know, I mean,
yeah.
if people are upset at your company, that's a crisis for your company.
Mm-hmm.
But if they're wrongly upset, it's not a crisis for them. The problem is they think it is.
Sure.
if they're rightly upset, then it's real crisis communication. If you've shut down your plant or you've had an explosion or there's an infectious disease outbreak, you have to talk to people, but you're not telling them don't worry about it because they're right to be worried about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the fourth corner is when hazard and outrage are both low, and you know I haven't found that to be a business opportunity. I mean, there's nothing to be done there.
Exactly.
But I earn my living in the other three corners of the map.
Uh-huh.
And you know, the probably the most important thing to say about that is it's three different toolkits. You know, you can be good at all three. I like to think I'm good at all three. Mm-hmm. But they have almost nothing in common.
Okay.
Now, that's one definition. Does that make sense to you?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Now, if you back off of that, what risk communication means increasingly in the world is it's just become a vogue term, you know, a faddish term for whatever kind of communication you were already doing. So, you know, technical people who think that the essence of talking to people about a risk is to teach them the technical details.
Right.
You know, they used to call that science education. Now they call it risk communication.
Communication. Okay.
Old-fashioned PR people who think the job is to tell folks everything's under control, we know what we're doing, don't worry your pretty little head about it, sweetheart, you know, it's not a problem. You know, and that kind of sort of palliative, half-truth, old-fashioned PR, they now call risk communication. You know, so all kinds of things that it seems to me have, you know, don't fit into any of the boxes of real risk communication, get called risk communication because the term is popular.
Okay.
Just to give you a concrete example, I have been working a good deal recently with the shale gas industry.
Okay. Oh, right.
And there are people in the shale gas industry, I mean, everybody in the shale gas industry agrees the industry does crappy risk communication and needs to learn how to do risk communication.
Now, is that the fracking thing?
That's the fracking thing,
got it.
Yes.
Okay.
you know, and everybody in that industry agrees, you know, they're doing a horrible job of talking to the public.
Right.
And that they need to improve or they're in trouble. Some of them mean by that, we need to learn how to sell the value of shale gas and how to explain, you know, that the risks are tiny and how to rebut the claims of the critics and how to keep Gasland from getting shown on TV. And, you know, we need to get better at one-sided promotional communication.
Okay.
And they're now calling that risk communication. Other people, you know, and I'm in the latter group, you know, when they say, you know, that industry needs to get better at risk communication, they mean it needs to come out of the closet and acknowledge its problems. It needs to be more candid about everything from what's in the fracking fluid, where they have made real progress, to, you know, why they had an accident, you know, last Tuesday and what went wrong and what they're going to do about it. It needs to be more responsive to people who are concerned. It needs to share control with critics and with regulators and set up accountability mechanisms so that it's not so reliant on trust. It needs to do a bunch of things that would, you know, reduce the level of public outrage. That's a very, I mean, those are two very different prescriptions that both get called risk communication.
Right. Interesting. So what are the? You probably already mentioned a couple of these, but I mean, when you go meet with clients, I mean, what are some of their shortcomings in all this when you're talking to them and sort of getting all their information and stuff? I mean, what are they missing with this crisis stuff?
Well, I mean, there are a couple of sort of characteristic errors. You know, one characteristic error, which is made by the technical people in among my clients, is the public just doesn't understand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they understood what we understand, if they knew the data the way we know the data, they wouldn't be upset.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, I mean, empirically, that's just false.
Right.
You know? I mean, it would be nice if the world were made that way, but it's not. And you know, if you enjoy paradoxes, consider the paradox of all these scientists and engineers who are deeply committed to the public paying attention to data, who are themselves paying absolutely no attention to the data that the public doesn't pay attention to data.
Right. Okay.
If these technical people actually were paying attention to data themselves, they would have long since realized that that's not the task.
Not the case, right.
So that, I mean, that's one enduring problem.
Okay.
A very different enduring problem is, and this is more typical of senior management in companies, is the view that the public ought not to have opinions in the first place. It ought not to be involved. You know, we own our factory. We already have to deal with regulators. That's enough. They are the stand-ins for the public.
Sure.
And all these people, all these neighbors or activists or other stakeholders who are interfering in our business
right.
should have no standing. And you know, the goal is to so the first group, the goal is to make those folks understand. For the second group, the goal is to make those folks go away.
Right.
And you know, I mean, that, I think that's a misreading of how society works. Certainly, how democratic and complex societies work. And it, it's interesting, in the same way that, the technical people are experiencing a paradox. They're ignoring the data. The data don't work.
Right.
The management people are, think about how to make this clear. The management people are ignoring a hunk of reality that they know better. They know perfectly well that stakeholders are important. They are themselves stakeholders. They go lobby the legislature, and they think they should have impact. But when activists do the same thing, or an organization of neighbors does the same thing, they're very upset. And in essence, what it is is outrage. That these controversies are not usually battles between outraged stakeholders and calm companies. They are battles between outraged stakeholders and outraged companies.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons why management imagines that it's reasonable to demand that stakeholders go away is because management is itself too outraged to think straight.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Is this making sense to you?
Oh, yeah. It's very interesting.
The third thing that I think that's very important is the strategies that work in outrage management are profoundly counterintuitive.
Okay.
Once you get it through your head that these people aren't going to go away, and you get it through your head that data's not going to work, and so you're looking for something new that might work. You understand
right.
that you can't ignore them, and you understand that you can't wow them with numbers.
Right.
And you're open to new possibilities, and along comes, a risk communication expert who says, well, all right, here's what we're going to do. The first thing we're going to do is we're going to make a long list of all the ways in which our critics are right, and we're going to put those in our own communications.
Mm-hmm.
Which is one of a dozen or so sort of routine things that I wind up recommending to clients. And, and a client will say, well, why on earth would we do that? My response is, well, because, you're in a different world now. The world you're used to being in is a world in which, and this is super important, I think, for PR people.
Mm-hmm.
The world in which you're used to being is a world in which you're talking to apathetic publics.
Mm-hmm.
And you're telling half-truths to apathetic publics.
Right.
And that's not dishonorable. The other side is telling the other half-truth.
Mm-hmm.
And the apathetic public is paying damn little attention to either one of you.
Right.
So you're doing the best job you can to get them to listen to your half of the truth, and your opponents are doing the best job they can to get the public to listen to the other, to their half of the truth. Neither of you is making much progress. By and large, the public is living its life and ignoring you.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you're used to. Then along comes a situation where you become interested in people who are interested. You're no longer focusing on large numbers of apathetic people. You are now focusing on smaller numbers of people who are involved and somewhere between skeptical and hostile.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. And everything changes.
Sure.
This is the in classic communication, this is the distinction between public relations, using the term literally, and stakeholder relations.
Right.
Now, PR people do plenty of stakeholder relations. I'm certainly not implying that PR people only talk to apathetic publics.
Right.
But traditional PR is about how you sell your side to apathetic publics.
Mm-hmm.
And very often PR people, when they have occasion to talk to aroused, skeptical, hostile publics, they do the same thing. They talk in sound bites, in brief, one-sided messages that sell their strengths.
Mm-hmm.
But now you're talking to someone who knows your weaknesses or half knows your weaknesses, is aware of your weaknesses,
mm-hmm.
and instead of that one-sided sales pitch being persuasive, it's a huge turnoff. It makes people think, you haven't learned anything, you're not being honest with me,
mm-hmm.
you think I'm stupid. So outraged people reliably get more outraged
mm-hmm.
when talked to with exactly the same kinds of communications that are ideal when you're talking to apathetic people.
Okay, right.
Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, so when you're speaking...
That's fundamental. So what one of the things that you wind up doing... if you're talking to people who are critical, and who know something and who are paying attention, is you stake out the middle. And you only have to do that if you're on the reassuring side of a controversy. So, I mean, a well-fought fight is a fight between the outrage-arousing extreme and the outrage-reassuring middle. So the people who are saying, oh, my God, we're all going to die, get to exaggerate.
Right.
But the people who are saying, no, we're not, get a grip, it's okay, mm-hmm. have to be very careful to identify what part of the truth the alarmists actually got
right
and acknowledge it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's not symmetrical. And when I work with activists, I teach them how to be one-sided. And when I work with companies, I teach them how to be two-sided, because if they're going to respond to their critics in a way that will be meaningful to people who are on the fence, who are paying attention and and genuinely concerned, mm-hmm. then they're going to need to take seriously the valid arguments of their critics. And similarly, a whole bunch of other things that follow from the same logic. They're going to need to set up accountability mechanisms, because the underlying assumption is you can't be trusted. You'll cheat me if you can.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to set up systems that persuade me that you can't, and then I trust you not to, because I know that I'll catch you if you do.
Mm-hmm.
They have to set up ways of sharing control, because people are less upset when they're involved in the management of an enterprise than when they're excluded from the management of an enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
They have to acknowledge prior misbehaviors. I mean, one of the routine things that make no sense at all if you're talking to apathetic publics, but are absolutely essential if you're talking to hostile stakeholders, mm-hmm. is to say, three awful things happened last year, this, this, and this, and before we talk about anything else, we're going to have to talk about those three mistakes and why they happened and what we've learned from them and what we're doing differently today.
Mm-hmm.
We know this about huge catastrophes. We know even the most benighted, one-sided, sales pitch kind of PR person knows that if you're BP now, you can't talk about your environmental record without mentioning the spill in the Gulf of Mexico.
Right.
That would be insane.
Sure.
Because the spill in the Gulf of Mexico, everybody's aware of.
Right.
But if you're talking about something that only 10% of the public is aware of, that only 10% of the public is aware of, the traditional PR advice would be, don't talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you want to clue in the 90% that don't know about it?
Right.
And the outrage management advice would be, if you're looking at stakeholders who already know about it, or who are, routinely on the website of your critics who are going to tell them about it, then if you don't mention it, you're an idiot.
Right.
So it's a different world, and the question is not, which set of skills is the right set. The question, or the two questions, one is when do you need one set, and when do you need the other.
Mm-hmm.
And the other question is, when they're in conflict, when you need them both, what's your priority?
Mm-hmm.
Now, that priority question leads me down another rabbit hole. If this is useful, I'll just keep talking.
Very useful. Just keep going.
Okay. I mean, that priority question leads me down another rabbit hole that I think is of interest and potential importance to your audience.
Mm-hmm.
The general tenor of, you know, the general sort of underlying assumption of most companies and most public relations people is that reputation is a single variable. The metaphor that's often used is a bank account. You know, where, you know,
right.
you do something good and
right.
that's a deposit,
you do
something bad and that's a withdrawal.
Right.
And you know, if reputation is one thing, then, you know, then being loved more and being hated less would be the same thing. You know, I mean, you know, the being loved more is increasing your positives, being hated, you know, is moving upward on this single scale,
yeah.
and being hated less is moving downward on this single scale. It turns out that's not true. The correlation between how loved you are and how hated you are is very low.
Mm-hmm.
Plenty of companies are much loved and much hated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you think about Walmart, for example.
Right.
You know, or, you know, Microsoft. Mm-hmm. Plenty of individuals are much loved and much hated. You think about Sarah Palin. You know, or Barack Obama. You know, there's lots of examples where positives and negatives are both very high.
Right, right, sure.
You know, and you know, so if you're a company in a local controversy, you know, the question of what can you do to be more loved, and the question of what can you do to be less hated, are just completely different questions.
Mm-hmm.
And they both have answers, you know. I mean, philanthropy will help you be more loved.
Mm-hmm.
You know, apologies will help you be less hated. And, you know, I mean, there's a long list of other things on you know, for both of those goals. But they're completely different goals that lead to completely different strategies. So the question that you know, my clients and your clients face is, well, you know, which is the priority? I mean, if you know, we're allocating limited time and resources and money, which is more important, to be more loved or to be less hated? And I think the evidence is overwhelming that especially if, you know, if you're managing controversy, being less hated matters much more.
Hmm. Okay.
You know, that you know, I mean, if you're trying to cite a facility and 20% of the community is trying to stop you, you know, doesn't want the facility, and 20% of the community really does want the facility. If you increase the folks who want it from 20 to 30%, the 20% who don't want it will still stop it. Because,
mm-hmm.
you know, I mean, nothing can be cited in a democratic society where 20% of the population is against it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you can reduce the folks who are against it from 20% to 10% without any increase in the folks who are for it, that's going to help you cite it a whole lot more than increasing the number who are for it.
Okay.
Now, there are exceptions. The most obvious exception is a referendum.
Sure.
You know, because, you know, in a referendum, the people, you know, people vote in a referendum whether they hate you or love
yeah.
you only a little, or they hate you or love you a lot.
Yeah.
You know, so in a referendum, getting the neutrals to love you a little,
mm-hmm.
you know, just barely enough to go to the polls and vote for you
mm-hmm.
is important.
Right.
And getting your dedicated opponents to hate you less doesn't do you any good. They still vote against you.
Sure.
But in a controversy that's not going to be resolved by voting, that's going to be resolved by advocacy, you know, that's going to be resolved by, you know, how many people show up at a public meeting and shout a lot,
mm-hmm.
then getting the people who hate you to hate you less so they decide to stay home and watch television
right.
is a major achievement. Mm-hmm. And it matters a great deal. It matters much more, does you much more good than getting people who love you to come to the meeting and shout back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so outrage management, is all about how to be less hated, and traditional PR is all about how to be more loved.
Exactly. Okay. That boils it down.
As you can tell, I mean, I've talked about this before.
Exactly.
I just start spouting.
I find it very fascinating because I haven't really heard this kind of. You know, this point of view before.
Well, I mean, the normal reaction of, you know, when I talk to a public relations audience, a traditional public relations
right.
audience, there's a piece of the audience that knows this already and has heard it before and is nodding their heads and saying, yeah, you know, when we're dealing with controversies, we need a new toolkit. You know, mm-hmm. Sandman, you've got different terminology for it,
right.
but it, you know, I knew that already.
Right. Okay.
There's a piece of the audience that is really resisting it, that is saying, absolutely not, you're crazy. What kind of drugs are you on?
Right.
And they're not always old farts. I mean, some of them
yeah.
are very young,
yeah.
fresh out of college, and somehow they absorbed the notion that one-sidedness is intrinsic to everything they do, and they're unable to conceptualize
mm-hmm.
what the circumstances might be where they would acknowledge the validity of the other side's
yeah.
point of view.
Right.
Both of those groups are fairly small. Maybe,
mm-hmm.
you know, maybe 10 or 15% of the room already is on my side. 10 or 15% of the room is completely unwilling to consider the possibility.
Mm-hmm.
And the other folks are reacting kind of the way you are.
Mm-hmm.
This is interesting. It's new. It sounds right. You know, it's sort of intuitively attractive. It's going to be, if I take it seriously, I'm going to have to change a lot of what I'm doing and a lot of what I'm recommending to my client or to my
right.
employer, because it's not what I'm doing now. It's a little scary. I'm afraid I can't sell it to my colleagues or I can't sell it to my clients, but I see your point. Once you say this, it's pretty damn obvious,
right.
and I feel a little stupid for having,
not
realized it myself.
Yeah.
And that
yeah.
that's the majority reaction.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have to say that, you know, I mean, that's the majority reaction while I'm in the room.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of regression,
mm-hmm.
you know, after I'm done. And people go back to the office and they're hanging out with folks who haven't, you know, who didn't go through the session. And people slide back into thinking reputation is all about being loved.
Right.
They slide back into thinking, your job is to tell your clients half of the story. You would never want to admit the other guy's half of the story. And they slide back into bad diagnoses and bad habits.
Mm-hmm.
So it's two steps forward, one step back.
Right.
Changing the field.
Sure.
But I think there's progress. There's certainly a lot of PR agencies where at least the crisis communication people, what they call crisis communication, which is what I call outrage management, the people that come in to manage a client's horrible publicity situation, a big, bad story,
right.
they get it. Most of them.
Right.
You know, I mean, they may have gotten it before they heard me. They certainly get it after they hear me. And when I work with a PR agency, it's usually the crisis intervention folks that bring me in.
Mm-hmm.
And the people that write, you know, routine press releases, there aren't very many of those
right.
left, frankly.
Yeah.
But, they're the ones who are never going to get it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it takes a generation to change a paradigm,
right.
and this is a different paradigm.
Is there? Could you give me an example of a recent thing that people might know about where your type of philosophy was used and it worked out?
I'm trying to think of some. I mean, that's the thing that makes that hard is that people might know about.
That's true.
For example, Maple Leaf Foods a couple of years ago had, and they're a Canadian, large Canadian manufacturer of deli meats and other processed
right.
foods. They killed a dozen or so people. I think more than that. It may have been 20 people. I don't remember. They killed a bunch of people
right.
With deli meats. I mean, it was Listeria in packaged deli meats, and a bunch of people died, mostly
right.
elderly people. And they, they handled it beautifully. They're not a client. I mean, they have become a client
mm-hmm.
since then, but,
right.
but uh, they didn't handle it beautifully because I was telling them what to do. They handled it beautifully because their instincts were wonderful. And Michael McCain, who's the CEO of the company of Maple Leaf, went on television and apologized. The Maple Leaf was out in front of the government in acknowledging what had gone wrong. I mean, they just did a very nice job.
Mm-hmm.
There are certainly it's actually not hard to find examples of companies doing some parts of it right the time.
Yep.
Let me give you a superb example from BP.
Okay.
Which did damn near everything wrong in Deepwater Horizon. But 20 years ago, BP had a spill in Huntington Beach, California. It was the American Trader tanker spilled off the coast of Huntington Beach and spilled oil, into the ocean off the coast of Huntington Beach. Mm-hmm. This was shortly after Exxon Valdez. There was a lot of media interest. It's a lot easier to get to Huntington Beach than it is to get to Valdez, Alaska.
Yep.
So there's a lot of coverage. Legally... The American Trader tanker was not BP's tanker. It was a contract carrier. BP had hired the tanker company. So as BP's CEO, CEO of BP America, James Ross, was flying to the scene from corporate headquarters in Cleveland. He was flying to Huntington Beach. On the plane, his lawyers were saying, look, under no circumstances are you to admit liability. Our defense is going to be the son of a bitch spilled our oil. We're the victim here. And you must not admit liability. We plan to contest liability.
Mm-hmm.
The communication people on the plane, whom I had trained, but I wasn't on the plane, but the communication people on the plane said, look, it's our oil. It's on its way from our oil well to our oil refinery. We hired the tanker company, and we vetted them for safety. If we hide behind the fact that it's not our tanker to somehow imply that we're not morally responsible for this spill, the outrage is going to go through the roof.
Right.
So what the CEO was being told is you have to take moral responsibility, but you can't take legal responsibility.
Right.
Turns out that's not hard. The words were crafted on the plane. The plane landed, the CEO held a news conference, and the reporter asked the key question. And the question was, do you consider this spill your company's fault?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And here's the answer. Our lawyers tell us that legally it's not our fault.
Right.
But we feel like it's our fault.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to act like it's our fault.
Okay.
That's a spectacular answer. The lawyer went home saying, thank God he said it's not our fault.
Right.
He preserved his defense.
Mm-hmm.
But 80 million people heard that soundbite on television that night and said to each other, I can't believe the CEO of an oil company has taken moral responsibility for a spill.
Mm-hmm.
6 months after that spill, BP had a better reputation locally, nationally, and internationally than it had had before the spill.
Mm-hmm.
Actually gained reputation through the process of the spill.
Right.
You compare that to what BP did last year. In 1990, BP took moral responsibility without taking legal responsibility.
Right. Mm-hmm.
In 2010, BP took legal responsibility without taking moral responsibility.
Exactly. Yep.
Which one worked?
Right.
There's a company that had it right, that knew how to do it. BP did a lot of things right in that period around 1990. They were trained in outrage management, and they got it, and at very high levels, they understood it. And it didn't stick. If you'd asked me in the early 90s, I would have said that's now part of the corporate culture.
Right.
And I would have been wrong, because they lost it. By the time Deepwater Horizon happened, there was nobody left in high places in the company who had been on that plane.
Mm-hmm.
There was nobody left who knew, who understood outrage management.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, that's simultaneously a good example and a bad example.
So, we're big on advice in our... Even though we're known as PR News, we're more like a how-to. But so if
What would be a good sort of starting point for communicators on this? I mean, what should they be? What should they start to think about if they're, you know, if they're thinking about sort of a risk communication and outrage management? I mean, where should they start?
The first thing they should do is ask themselves every time they're doing a piece of communication: am I talking to apathetic people or am I talking to upset people?
Okay.
The second thing they should do is, if the answer to the first question is both, they should ask a follow-up question: which is more important to achieving my goals?
Right.
You know, do I need to be loved more in order to get where I'm going? In which case, apathetic people is where you get to be loved more.
Mm-hmm.
Or do I need to be hated less? In which case, you know, upset people is where you get to be hated less.
Right. Okay.
Okay. Then the third thing they should do is, you know, if their answer to the first two questions tells them they're in the outrage management corner of the map, they're in a situation where people are upset and their goal is to calm them down,
mm-hmm.
you know, then they need to say, all right, what do I know or what can I learn about what calms down people who are upset?
Okay.
And, you know, I mean, think about your marriage, think about your teenage children, think about other situations where you wanted to preserve a relationship and mitigate outrage rather than prove that you were right to some hypothetical, you know, neutral arbitrator, you know. And you know, I mean, everybody's good at that when they diagnose it right, or at least reasonably good at that. I mean, you know, think about what you do when you're having a fight with your wife, when your teenager is you know, wants to kill you. When you know, think of what you do at work when you're in a pissing match with a colleague.
Right.
You know, and they're going to be a colleague for a long time,
mm-hmm.
and your goal is not to convince them they're jerks, because
right.
A, it's very hard to convince people that they're jerks, and B, if you succeed in convincing the guy that he's wrong and you're right, he resents you.
Right.
You know? So proving that you're right is not your goal, and you sort of already know that with your spouse. You already know that with your kids. You already know that with your office mate.
Sure.
But somehow you imagine that it's an outraged stakeholder, you know, or a whole bunch of them. It's an activist group, and the goal is you know, you somehow imagine the goal is to prove them wrong.
Right.
You know, so yeah, as if that ever worked at home.
Never.
You know,
yeah, you're right.
So I mean, I guess that would be my next piece of advice is marshal what you already know from your private life,
mm-hmm.
you know, about how you deal with people who are upset when you don't want to write them off. You want to win them over, or you want to part way win them over.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then you know the fourth piece of advice would you know which gets more complicated is you know run through a list of six or seven sort of standard things that you should want to do, all of which are uncomfortable. You're going to want to acknowledge your prior misbehavior. You're going to want to stake out the middle, which is to say, validate your critics' valid arguments. You don't validate their crap, because, you know, I mean, some of what they're saying is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't validate their crap, but you validate their valid arguments with more attention than rebutting their crap.
Right.
You know, so that's something you're going to want to do. You're going to want to share control.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to want to build accountability mechanisms. You're going to want to acknowledge prior misbehaviors. Did I mention that already? And apologize for them and seek forgiveness for things you've done that were genuinely wrong in the past.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to want to address motives, you know, that may not be on the table. So, I mean, if, you know, you're going to want to look beyond the motives that people are claiming and start addressing the things that they're not avowing, but
yeah.
if you analyze it, you can tell they're feeling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you can get lists like this off my website.
Yeah.
There's a relatively short list of very basic things you always need to do
yeah.
when you're talking to people who are upset.
Yeah, I think I saw those. I think I saw those little bullets in there. Yeah, this is really really interesting stuff for sure. I don't want to keep you too much longer. I think I do have a good base on which to grow here.
For me, the thing that I want to emphasize, because it's what people from the PR industry often misunderstand about what I'm saying. I'm not saying that telling half-truths selling your side, calling it telling half-truths is a little tendentious.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that selling your side is dishonorable.
Right.
And I'm not saying that it's ineffective
in
general. I'm saying it's inapplicable when your goal is to ameliorate outrage.
Yeah. Right.
You keep on doing that in scenes where it's the right thing to do. I'm not your preacher. I'm not saying how dare you be one-sided.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying it's really stupid to be one-sided when you're talking to the other side.
Right. Right, exactly. Yeah. Yep. All this is it makes a lot of sense for sure. Definitely does. If I have any sort of follow-up, can I shoot you a quick email or something? Or
absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. And obviously, insofar as your format allows you to do so, send people to my website.
It certainly will.
It's not a commercial site.
Yep.
It's a purely an educational site.
Right. So,
you can also tell them to call me and pay me money, but the website is not that. The website is just, my effort to teach the world what I think they ought to be doing.
So what you do is you operate your own consultancy. Is that the?
That's correct.
Okay. And business is probably pretty good these days.
Yeah, business. I mean, I'm getting old. I've been threatening to retire since 2001.
Right.
And business is as good as I have insufficient character to say no.
Right.
I always have more work than I can do.
Sure.
I'm a crappy manager, so I didn't start an agency.
Right. Exactly.
I do it as a sole practitioner.
Right.
And you may want to talk about this. One thing that's interesting is, if you'd asked me 20 years ago when I was, sort of developing these models and this terminology, I would have said one of two things is going to happen. Either nobody will buy it, nobody will think it's right, or I'll get undersold. It'll become a commodity product. Everybody will understand how to do outrage management because these are simple principles. It's like I'm one of the world's leading experts in tic-tac-toe.
Sure.
This is not very complicated stuff, and I'll have to find another gig.
Right.
Neither of those things happened. I'm famous and rich and alone. There aren't a lot of people, that have undersold me and are replicating my advice. There are some, but relatively few. And the response continues to be like your response. It's an approach avoidance response. People are intrigued. They're interested. Mm-hmm. They want to write stories about it. They want to look at my website. They want to bring me in to talk to their board.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't get integrated into their culture. And 10 years later, they're intrigued again.
Right. Right.
It's a little frustrating, but it's fine for my business model,
exactly.
but it's frustrating for my, from my legacy.
The problem remains, and it's, it's still there.
Yes.
Just one more question. What has, people, this is a big topic amongst communications people, the whole social media, digital PR stuff. I mean, has that affected your principles at all here in terms of...
The basic answer is no, but there are two changes, one of which is obvious and much talked about, and the other of which I think is also obvious, but it's not talked about as much. The obvious, much talked about one, and I'll mention it, but I don't think I need to discuss it, is it's a 24/7 news cycle. There's no such thing as a slow news day.
Right.
You never have more than an hour to respond. All that stuff. Everybody knows that.
Yeah.
The other change, and this is, I think, maybe worth underlining, and certainly related to my work, there used to be this very rigid distinction between the individual complaining stakeholder and the public controversy. If a customer or a neighbor was angry at you and they wrote an angry letter, it was a letter, and you it came in the mail. And you answered it or you didn't, and your answer was defensive or it was snippy or it was dismissive or it was responsive or it was empathic, it was whatever it was, but that was just between you and that individual.
Right.
And public controversies were in the mainstream media, and you knew they were public controversies, and you responded to them in a very different way.
Right.
That distinction is almost gone,
mm-hmm.
Because now the individual who's angry at you, you know, instead of writing you a letter, they post something on YouTube.
Right.
Or they post something on their blog, or they tweet to all the people that are following their tweets. And every angry stakeholder now has an interested audience.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't used to be true.
Sure.
So that, I mean, you know, so, you know, now when you know, when somebody is on the social media, complaining about your company's performance, you know, the decision of whether and how to respond to them is not mostly about them. It's mostly
right.
about the people who are watching. And if it goes viral, that could be millions of people. And if it doesn't go viral, it's still hundreds of people.
Yeah.
So I routinely say to clients, look, it was a tough call 10 years ago
mm-hmm.
when to take an issue seriously and when not to. And there, you know, 10 years ago, it often made sense to say, you know, for PR people to say, don't respond, don't give it air, don't give it attention, you know, it'll die of its own weight if you ignore it.
Mm-hmm.
That distinction between, you know, tiny issues that you could ignore and big issues that you couldn't
mm-hmm.
was a sensible distinction.
Yeah, sure.
It's now an insane distinction. the tiny issues come back to haunt you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if an activist group in Sri Lanka is bitching and moaning about your company, on their website in Sri Lanka,
mm-hmm.
if somebody starts an activist group in Bolivia, they'll find that website in 20 minutes.
Sure. Yep.
You know, and 20 minutes later, they'll be talking to the activists in Sri Lanka,
mm-hmm.
and the next morning when they meet with the company's plant manager in Bolivia, they're going to say, well, why should we trust you? Look how
happened.
You betrayed those people in Sri Lanka.
Yeah.
A plant manager in Bolivia may not even know where Sri Lanka is.
Right.
You know, but activists have globalized much better than corporations.
Uh-huh.
And every controversy now has an audience.
Mm-hmm.
So even if somebody is, you know, has a complaint that's foolish and exaggerated, and what you really want to tell them is you know, get a life.
Mm-hmm.
And that might have been an okay thing
right.
to tell them
exactly.
10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Now you got a lot of people watching,
right.
And the people watching are on a seesaw. If you are responsive and empathic, and you're saying, yeah, you're right, we messed up, and we're going to do X and Y for you, and they say that's X and Y isn't enough. I want you to do A, B, C, D, and E.
Mm-hmm.
And you write back and say, well, maybe we can do A, but I don't think we can do the rest of those.
Right.
And they say, well, and then I'm going to sue your ass. You know, I mean, that dialogue, which used to happen just between, you know, your attorney and them,
mm-hmm.
now happens with an audience. And that audience, you know, if they see you being responsive and the complainer being unsatisfiable,
mm-hmm.
then they get on your side.
Yep.
If they see you being unresponsive and the complainer getting no attention, there's examples of that,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the PR media every day where, you know, people tweeted a complaint and got no, there was one, I think yesterday where, you know, somebody missed the flight and tweeted a complaint, no answer, tweeted again how angry he was, no answer,
mm-hmm.
and then tweeted something sarcastic about, well, at least he got a chance to watch his favorite TV show,
right.
And got an answer. You know, which ignored the sarcasm or missed the sarcasm, but, you know, basically, you know, somebody in the company had a policy of ignoring complaints and responding to things that looked positive.
Right. Right.
And got caught at it.
Right.
That might have made sense 10 years ago. It makes
yeah.
no sense at all
no
today.
Sense. Yeah. Very good. It's interesting. Hope to be able to use you as a source in other stories, too.
Come Absolutely.
We're always doing our crisis stuff here, so it's a huge topic. And,
well, my pleasure. I enjoy talking to you.
Yeah.
I mostly just spouted, but
that's okay.
You know,
that's okay.
I enjoyed spouting. Send me the MP3 when
you
can.
Yep, I'll get it together.
And send me the story when it's, you know, you actually print something or it's all online.
Well, no, it's both. It appears online. around Tuesday of next week. It'll go out to subscribers in print form on Monday.
And okay, well, I mean, if you can, send me both. Send me a PDF of the story and the link to the online version.
Sure, will do. Will do.
Excellent.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the time.
My pleasure. Okay. Nice talking with you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.